Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Some federal workers in New Hampshire feel the pinch of the partial government shutdown. State lawmakers consider helping those workers with state unemployment funds. Executive Councilor Andrew Valinsky considers a run for governor in 2020, and the Granite State gets its first kid governor. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. Give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. or post on our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Ethan DeWitt, reporter for the Concord Monitor, Dave Solomon, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader. And making her debut today on the Roundup is NHPR's Sarah Gibson. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning, Peter. Morning.
And just a reminder to listeners and to everybody here at the table that we are broadcasting a live video of this radio show. Very easy to listen and watch. Again, search for NHPR Exchange on Facebook and you'll find the live stream there. And give us a call if you've got questions or comments about the week's news. 1-800-892-6477. The big news this week so far anyway has been that federal workers are still feeling the pinch from the federal government shutdown, a second paycheck missed as of today. NHPR's Sarah Gibson has been reporting on TSA workers who've been working without pay because they are considered essential. So, Sarah, tell us about some of the reporting you've done there. Who have you spoken to?
Sure. So not many TSA workers are super eager to go on record, but I've been talking to a couple of different folks, and one is Valeria Lewis. So she's a former TSA worker who's now the union rep for about 164 TSA workers here in New Hampshire. Most of them are at the Manchester-Boston Regional Airport. So we've been speaking, and she is pretty forthcoming about how exasperating and, frankly, critical their situation is, given the fact that they haven't been paid for a while and have a lot of bills to pay this month.
So is that how they would describe morale at the TSA, exasperating?
Yeah, the morale is not good. I mean, if you look at national numbers, there's kind of a record number of people not showing up to work, TSA workers. We can talk about that a little bit. It's called a sick out because these workers are not legally allowed to strike. So about twice as many TSA workers as usual aren't coming to work nationally. That number isn't quite as dramatic, I've heard, in New Hampshire, but some folks are not going to work.
Okay. And so is there a coordinated sick day thing happening, or is it just a larger number of people are just deciding independently, I'm going to call in sick today because I don't feel like working without pay?
It's hard to say. So when I spoke to Valeria Lewis, the union rep, she said, and people are making really basic decisions right now about what to pay for and what not to. So can they go for a couple weeks not paying their rent, not paying their bills, making basic decisions about meals? So some of these folks work actually part-time at the TSA. And so if you have another job where you are actually getting paid, you might want to ramp up those hours and be working there rather than go in and essentially work for free. That said, a lot of people have been expressing pride in their work as TSA workers. You know, they're kind of on the front lines of security for this country in many ways. And so, the vast majority of people are still going to work as TSA workers, even if they're not being paid.
So what have the TSA folks you've spoken to said, if anything, about security and safety? Is the federal government shutdown compromising that in some way?
So the spokesman I spoke to from TSA's national office, they're really careful about what information they're giving to journalists. You'll notice they're tweeting every day the amount of people calling in sick. They're acknowledging it's twice as what it usually is. Mm-hmm. They're not saying what airports those are in. because of security concerns. They basically don't want to say, hey, everyone, Atlanta has a real shortage, and kind of raise the alarm for potentially a bad actor who wants to target that place. We do know through news reports that some airports are certainly having long security lines because there just aren't enough TSA workers to man or woman those lines. So there's that concern. And then there's also something called good financial standing that TSA workers need to be in.
Right. Good financial standing. They basically have to keep their own financial house in order to keep security clearances, right? Is that what it is?
Yeah. So this is the case for Coast Guard workers, for various people who work for the federal government who need to have security clearance. In order to maintain that, you need to be in good financial standing. So my understanding from the union rep is that if, say, February 1st, you don't get your rent in to your landlord because you haven't been paid for a couple weeks, that landlord basically gets the credit collection agencies on you, that'll alert Homeland Security, and that will essentially catalyze a process where Homeland Security is telling you you have 30 days to get back into good financial standing. Otherwise, you lose your security clearance. And if you don't have a good security clearance, you can't work at that airport security line. You could potentially be terminated, she said. TSA spokespeople have pushed back a little bit on that and said, you know, this is a crisis moment. We understand some people can't pay their bills, so we don't think we're going to terminate someone if they haven't paid their rent on February 1st.
Listeners, during this part of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, we'd love to hear your stories of the government shutdown, whether you are a federal worker affected by this, related to a federal worker affected by this, or maybe you're depending on a federal grant of some kind that's not coming through right now. We'd love to hear your story, or if there's stories that are related to something I haven't just mentioned, please do let us know. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email also works, exchange@nhpr.org. Regarding those federal grants, Sarah Gibson, there are lots of programs that rely on federal grants, but those may be affected somehow. How are those doing?
Yeah, so that's been kind of interesting because there are all of these people who work in New Hampshire for us. They're, you know, the people who run the transportation systems in our towns and who run programs for young kids in our towns. And they're really worried right now because in addition to state funding and grant funding from foundations, they also apply for grants and get grants from the federal government. So one example is a program that's really been lauded and become a model. It's called ACERT. It's in Manchester. It basically partners, it's a collaboration between police officers and social workers to help kids who've experienced trauma in Manchester. And they got a grant at the end of last year to massively expand their programming. They got more than $1 million promised from the federal government. They can't access any of that money right now. So they're providing services, they're maintaining their level of service. They can't expand as they had intended this month. Same goes for some transportation initiatives in other parts of New Hampshire. In Nashua, for instance, the most requested passenger route is from Nashua to the Walmart in Amherst. That service was about to be provided this month. It isn't because the money for that service is coming from the federal government and those funds simply can't be accessed right now.
Can I ask you a question about that? How much of this federal government shutdown is affecting people working in transportation?
Yeah, well, there was a press conference a couple days ago in Manchester with the MTA, the Manchester Transit Authority. Passengers should not see a change in their services. If for some reason the shutdown were to last until the spring or, you know, people would be getting really worried, you would see your services maybe getting cut. But right now, cities help pay for those transportation costs. So essentially, the city is kind of loaning or paying for the full services of transportation in a number of cities in New Hampshire.
So this federal government shutdown is getting local attention from politicians here, including Governor Chris Sununu, who spoke on Wednesday about the shutdown.
They all need to act like adults, get in the room, put forth compromises on both sides and figure it out. There's a lot of political grandstanding going on. And at the end of the day, individual families are being very drastically financially impacted. And that has a real hit, not just to citizens here in New Hampshire, but all across this country. So political grandstanding never gets anyone anywhere. And Washington does it worst of all. And frankly, they're all to blame.
They're all to blame, says Governor Chris Sununu. Turning to you now, Ethan DeWitt, from the Concord Monitor. From the legislative side, few issues to consider. Earlier this week, Democratic lawmakers in Concord were mulling some ideas to assist federal workers with unemployment benefits from the state surplus, I believe it was. Was that correct?
Well, the state, partially correct. So the state surplus would be used to kind of help some of these programs that Sarah was just talking about. Some, for instance, Section 8 and food stamps, that kind of thing. But the proposal that they're looking at with unemployment insurance, basically, right now, there are two types of workers affected, federal workers affected by the shutdown. There are those who are furloughed, and those are the people who are sent home and not given pay. And then there are those who, I can't remember the exact term for it, but they're essentially kind of not allowed to go home. They must keep working, but they aren't getting paid. The first category, the furloughed people who go home, they are eligible for unemployment insurance. That's under state law. That's under federal guidance from the Department of Labor. But the guidance and the state law is clear that those who show up to work don't qualify for unemployment insurance.
Technically, they still have a job,
according
to the law.
In order to qualify for unemployment insurance, you need to not be giving any services and not be payable for any services. And so if you are giving services, then and technically they're payable as well because there is a congressional bill that guarantees back pay for everybody if and when the government finally reopens. And so that the Democrats have said, and other states are taking a page from other states like California and Colorado, they're saying that our Department of Employment Security, which administers the unemployment insurance funds and also takes in money from the federal government, should use those funds not just for the workers who are sent home, but the workers who are also made to work without pay. And effectively, this would be a way to give them some money. They would have to pay it back once they did get their back pay. And the federal Department of Labor said this is kind of not what this fund is intended for and is urging states such as California and now potentially New Hampshire to back away from this.
Is the terminology you were looking for earlier, Ethan, essential employees versus non-essential employees?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. We did speak earlier this week with Employment Security Commissioner George Kapatis, who said that states have been told not to pay unemployment benefits to workers who have been working unpaid during the furlough.
We've been advised by the feds that if you pay these workers, you will not be reimbursed. In addition to that, we'd be out of compliance, and I'm not sure what other ramifications would happen at that point.
Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, want to get your insight on what's been happening in Concord with respect to the partial federal government shutdown. What are your thoughts on this earlier in the week Democratic proposal and also the governor's response to it?
Well, the governor's response, I would like to say the clip that you played in which he sort of sounded like he was taking a middle ground and saying everyone is to blame came at after an executive council meeting in interviews with reporters. But during the executive council meeting, he was the issue was raised at the opening of the meeting by Democratic Councilor Deborah Pignatelli from Nashua, who pressed her fellow councilors to write a letter urging the state legislature to take some action to help federal employees. And this prompted a heated exchange on the matter between the two, in which the governor didn't take very much of a middle position at all. He said he thought the president had put forward a reasonable compromise, alluding to the president's proposal of we'll reopen the government in return for the wall funding and a three-year extension on protection for the Dreamers. He said that's a reasonable compromise. It's been put forward. Congress should take it up and get the government open. So from a political standpoint, the governor's taken the position that he thinks the president has put forward a reasonable compromise, although he does feel both sides are acting rather childishly in the matter. The heart of the issue is going to turn into whether New Hampshire wants to join the other states and confront the federal government on this question of releasing unemployment funds for the employees who are being forced to work without pay, despite warnings from the federal government that that would result in certain sanctions. That's been suggested by Democratic leadership indirectly. It was suggested by Executive Counselor Pignatelli, and Democrats have scheduled a press conference for 9:30 today to propose a letter from House and Senate leadership to the governor as well, urging some action regarding this matter.
Go ahead, Ethan.
And I should just add that there are states that actually have actively done it. And one kind of consideration when you're looking at the Democrats' proposal, they're proposing fast-tracking a bill, which even at its fastest, if you were to try to push it through committees and through votes in both chambers, would take probably 1 or 2 weeks to get through both chambers. At that point, who knows what will be the situation in Washington, whether the government will be open. Some of these other governors have taken to executive orders. We asked Governor Sununu this week whether he would consider that, and he said he's waiting for the proposals from the Democrats. So I think it seems like he hasn't ruled out that he would go along with this idea, and the Democrats seem to have other ideas, and he says he's considering them all. But it doesn't seem like he wants to be the first one to jump in terms of signing that executive order and starting it right away.
Well, as Dave mentioned, there's a press conference scheduled for 9:30 this morning. NHPR.org is where we'll be following the story as it unravels today. Please do check back to NHPR.org for updates on that. Ethan, I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the reporting you did this week on the shutdown regarding dairy farmers, because they have been impacted by the shutdown. Could you tell us how?
Sure. So one of the many departments that's being affected by the shutdown is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And what is interesting is that so dairy farmers, listeners may be aware, have been struggling for a while. Basically, consumption is not meeting the supply that they have, and prices have been falling in free fall for years. I think it's every 5 years, there's the Farm Bill that's passed by Congress. This is a big deal for the agriculture business. This year's Farm Bill, dairy farmers say, was actually very good for them. There's a new program called Dairy Margin Coverage, which is essentially kind of like insurance smaller farms, and basically it provided kind of more stability for them. But the issue is that with the shutdown, they may not be able to avail themselves of this new program, and that may affect some of their decisions in the next few months when they start needing some of these programs, once they start needing to pay for feed and other essentials.
Mm-hmm. Safe to assume you'll be keeping in touch with these sources to see how they're faring as this continues?
Yes. It seems like something that, if this were to continue past March or April, this would be a serious problem for them.
Listeners, the phone number for you to call, 1-800-892-6477. Email at nhpr.org. Just a little bit after the break, we're going to be talking about the state's new 10-year mental health plan, which makes significant changes to the state's mental health system. What's at stake in how New Hampshire cares for folks with mental illness? 1-800-892-6477. I want to thank NHPR's Sarah Gibson for joining us for this part of the program. Sarah, thank you very much. Really appreciate your insight.
You're welcome.
Again, listeners, 1-800-892-6477. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This is The Roundup. We'll be right back.
For me, it was very easy.
I did it online, which was incredibly simple.
Oh, it's very quick and easy process to become a sustaining member.
I like that it comes out of my checking account as opposed to my credit card.
Switching your monthly membership from your credit card to your checking account is an even better way for you to support NHPR. Many sustainers have already made the switch, so join them today. It's a little change that makes a big difference. Go to nhpr.org for more information, and thanks.
Coming up next week on The Exchange, a show you should know about, new UNH President James Dean outlined his vision yesterday on the future of UNH, and we're going to sit down with him on Monday and find out how he plans to make UNH one of the top 25 public universities in the country. You can email your questions for James Dean now to exchange at nhpr.org. Right now, we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week. on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And in the studio with me now, Dave Solomon of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. I'm Peter Biello. Thanks very much for being here. So, Dave Solomon, the state released its 10-year mental health plan, and for the first time, the public has had a chance to view the plan's ambitions and some of the details. What are some of the problems the state's hoping to address with this plan?
Well, the final version of the plan that was released earlier this week is almost identical to the draft version that was released several weeks ago as a run-up to the public hearings. So we had a very good idea of where this was headed, and it came out very much where it was expected. And the plan is designed to address several deficiencies in the state's system of treating people who have mental health conditions. It calls for a large expansion of services and a reorganization of those services into a structure very similar to what the state is designing in its response to the opioid addiction crisis, which is a hub-and-spoke model, meaning, in simple language, create one-stop shopping for mental health services, one number you can call, one place you can go to that's close to where you live, where you can be evaluated and then referred to the appropriate services, whatever they may be, from counseling to housing to drug addiction recovery and so forth. There's also a call for additional psychiatric beds for people who are in immediate crisis and need residential treatment. There's a vast shortage of those. There's a call for increasing the volume of these mobile crisis units, which people in the mental health field view as very useful and very successful in dealing with mental health crisis. It's essentially a SWAT team comprised of three or four professionals in the different disciplines needed to treat mental health people in a mental health crisis with a large van and an apartment where they can take the people in until they can transition them to service. So they need more of these mobile crisis response teams. And of course, overall, investments in housing services for people after they've gone through the treatment system so that we can get them out the back door of places like New Hampshire Hospital and create more spaces for incoming traffic. All of this is going to cost a lot of money over the 10-year period, we're going to find ourselves in a situation where the governor feels very strongly against a long-term and permanent expansion of the state budget, enlargement of the state budget to deal with these kind of situations, and a Democratic legislature that feels the state has the resources to do so.
Yeah, because sorry to interrupt you, Dave.
Come to a crisis.
Right. There's going to be a legislative component, and I wonder if some of it's going to have to do with the money that's being spent, right? Because this, maybe you can clarify for me. Does this involve new money, new spending, or is it a reallocation of resources that are already available, or is it kind of a combination of the
two? There's about $20 million in new spending that's in there that would become a permanent and ongoing part of the budget for departments like Health and Human Services. A big component of the plan, too, is a call to increase the state's rate of payment to Medicaid providers. The state decides what Medicaid providers get paid for certain services, and they're relied on, many in the mental health population rely on Medicaid as their health insurance. And the state of New Hampshire pays the lowest Medicaid rates in the country, 58% less than the national average.
And what is the effect of that?
The effect of that is providers will give hospital treatment, emergency room treatment. They will meet their obligation as required by federal law to treat patients, whatever payment or non-payment they can make. But they are not going to open new hospital beds. They're not going to expand capacity at those low rates.
Yeah. So,
provider rates are sort of the elephant in the room when you come to pretty much, and not just mental health, but kind of across the board. Substance use disorder and healthcare. As Dave was saying, it does sort of, hospitals say that it stymies their ability to expand. There was money in, I think it was 2017, either the budget or a bill in 2017, that was meant for designated receiving facilities. And this would basically give kind of another door for people with mental health conditions to kind of get treatment quicker. But no hospital actually would bid on that. And one reason that they cited was that the reimbursement rates are too low. That it's just, you know, it isn't, there's no way to kind of make it financially solvent. So that money ended up going to some of these mobile crisis response units, which, while important and are kind of effective at late hours of the night, are not the same as creating new beds and creating a new doorway in the hospital. It's just essentially kind of a better way to get care, get people care in rural areas, but it doesn't solve the bigger problems.
So this reimbursement rate is a bigger issue than perhaps most people realize, a bigger part of this 10-year plan. So regarding the 10-year plan and the legislative component, I mean, legislatures turn over pretty frequently. How much of the success of this plan is dependent on the feelings of the legislature as a whole? And in other words, if the legislature in a couple of years decides, this isn't for us, this isn't right for New Hampshire anymore, can they scrap it?
Certainly the rate could be cut. The Medicaid rate, reimbursement rate could be cut. And that would, you know, definitely, that's not something that would be set in stone at all. I think some of the bigger kind of proposals, the governor's kind of floated the idea for moving the secure psychiatric unit, for instance, out of the state prison. That's going to require a lot of upfront capital. There are proposals in the mental health plan, the 10-year mental health plan, to create new beds, potentially using this new youth services center in Manchester to kind of create an outlet for adult patients as well. So there are kind of more sort of upfront infrastructure considerations being made. But then there are the longer term questions of how do you keep the system funded? How do you keep the care funded? How do the rates stay funded?
Mm-hmm. And Dave Solomon, can I ask you to put this in a broader context for us? Because as far as I understand, this is not the state's first 10-year mental health plan. There was one roughly 10 years ago. Was there?
There was one 10 years ago, and it ran. It was very ambitious. It made many of the same suggestions. And it ran smack dab into the harsh fiscal realities of the Great Recession, 2009, 2010, and it was basically shelved. Rather than investing in some of the initiatives that were proposed at the time, the state made drastic cuts to the Health and Human Services budgets. And in fact, in the case of the Department for Children, Youth and Families and some of the other social service agencies, they're not even back to funding levels that existed in 2011. So you can imagine where the budget for those agencies would be if instead of having been cut drastically at those times, they had increased incrementally at the rate of inflation in the ensuing 10 years, we might be in a very different place. So the state is not only trying to dig itself out of the hole for not funding its plan 10 years ago, but it's also under a federal court order to implement a settlement with the Disability Rights Center over its mental health treatment of people with over its treatment with people with disabilities. That's costing it $35 million as well, and has already paid out $6 million in a settlement over abuse of children that were under the supervision of the Department of Children, Youth, and Services. So it's going to pay for these issues one way or the other.
And there's certainly a lot of additional pressure. I think that there's a good chance that there is some sort of compromise. We don't know what it'll look like, but you have an ongoing lawsuit from the ACLU and from hospitals over the boarding crisis. And you have the governor and Democrats and Republicans all saying that this is an issue that they're going to take seriously this biennium. So we'll see what happens in the budget, but it looks like something will probably emerge.
Dave, I want to ask you about a response from a community partner who has a big stake in this. Ken Norton, head of the National Alliance on Mental Illness in New Hampshire, praised the release of this plan, but he also said transforming the mental health system, quote, will require a public and private partnership, including investment commitment and collaboration from hospitals, healthcare providers, insurance carriers, community mental health centers, law enforcement, courts, and corrections, and other key stakeholders. So that's the quote from Ken Norton of NAMI. Dave, in your view, what's the likelihood that all these players are going to be able to come together to make this happen?
Well, something will happen. The extent to which it will be funded remains to be seen. The traditional way these things are addressed is the governor puts forward his budget, and then the House and the Senate put it through their ringer, and we see what comes out in at the end of June for a state budget for the next 2 years. But the Democratic Senate has gotten a little ahead of the game this year, as does happen from time to time. And they've produced some bills that call for significant increases in appropriations for mental health beds, for reimbursement through Medicaid, for a variety of positions in the Department for Children, Youth, and Services, things that will ultimately have to be funded through the budget if they are going to be funded. So it's going to be a negotiation between the governor and the legislature. And it's entirely possible that the Democratic-led legislature will put forward a budget that the governor just feels includes too much new, permanent, and ongoing spending that enlarges government in a way he doesn't approve of.
Listeners, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. We'll talk a little bit more about how mental health is handled in New Hampshire in just a moment. Want to let you know briefly about some of the other stories that we've reported on this week, including a new report that says school discipline in New Hampshire is disproportionately harsh on students of color and students with disabilities. The report comes from a coalition of advocacy organizations called the Juvenile Reform Project, and it finds that minority students and students with disabilities are twice as likely to get suspended as their white, non-disabled peers. NHPR's Sarah Gibson quoted a member of that group as saying those students need extra support, which they can't get while they're suspended from school. Also, the Dover High School teacher at the center of an uproar over a recent racist incident in the classroom will keep his job. John Carver gave the class assignment late last year that led Dover students to sing racist lyrics to the tune of Jingle Bells. It was caught on video, and Carter was put on paid leave while the district investigated. Now, Carter will stay on leave for the rest of the academic year while undergoing training in issues pertaining to race, bias, and privilege. In a statement, the Seacoast NAACP condemned the decision and expressed doubts that they could continue working with the district to respond to the incident. And New Hampshire's child advocate is endorsing a bill to create 77 positions to better protect children. We spoke about Moira O'Neill last week, and she says 57 of those positions are for child protective workers. The rest are for supervisors. She says the cost of $8.5 million over 2 years is reasonable. Speaking on The Exchange earlier this week, O'Neill responded to a GOP House leader's recent comment that DCYF received funding for 33 new positions last session, but that some of those positions remain empty, in part because of turnover, and in part because some people take new jobs at the agency. So they may not have necessarily left, but they're filling new positions, and so those positions open up again. Listeners, again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I want to ask a few more questions about the mental health picture in New Hampshire, and I'll ask you, Dave Solomon, because you reported on this for the Union Leader, that 12 Senate Democrats signed on with Democratic Senator Tom Sherman of Rye to co-sponsor legislation that would divert $6 million from the state budget to various construction or encourage construction and staffing issues at mental health units at various hospitals. We were just talking about the 10-year plan. Is this related at all to the 10-year plan?
That particular issue really gets to the core of the whole context for this debate over mental health services, social services for children, and how we're going to improve them all. So it's helpful to sort of pick that one apart a bit. The idea there is to take $6 million from the state surplus that's in the bank. The state actually has $200 million left unspent, about $100 million of which is designated for the rainy day fund, the mm-hmm. state savings account. That leaves about, you know, $95 to $100 million in surplus that the legislature and governor have to decide what to do with.
And some are arguing that the mental health situation in New Hampshire is that rainy day.
Is that rainy day, and it could be used for that. The heart of Senator Sherman's bill, which has virtually universal support in the Democratic caucus of the Senate, is to double the reimbursement rate to the hospitals for psychiatric beds to incentivize them to finally create the capacity that the state has been trying to create for at least 4 years now to address the boarding of mental health patients in emergency rooms at hospitals statewide. The state asked the hospitals last year to build new capacity. The hospitals basically declined. They felt $700 a day for these beds is not adequate. What would be adequate, they must have been asked, because the current proposal of has doubled that amount. Senator Sherman's bill would double the state's Medicaid reimbursement rates for these psychiatric beds to $1,400 a day. And the hospitals say, now that's enough to get us to build these beds, to staff them, and to maintain them. And the state would put in another $3 million to facilitate and support the capital costs of creating this additional capacity. And one hospital has already said they're shovel ready to go. And while there probably would not be a lot of debate about using $6 million for that purpose, and another $3 million, by the way, for housing once people are out of these psychiatric beds so they don't end up back in them, for a total of $9 million, there would probably be a good consensus around pulling that out of the surplus. The debate will be, but if we do that, we are enlarging this budget by $9 million every year moving forward, and that's going to be the crux of the debate. The governor is against using one-time money for long-term problems, so he will have to address the question, what then is the solution to funding the long-term problem?
Yeah, he's been pretty consistent about that message, not using one-time funds for ongoing obligations. I want to shift gears really quickly before the break and talk about, you know, something simple like business tax cuts. And maybe I'll start with you, Ethan. I wanted to check in with you about that because there's a debate happening in the Senate over that. Some Democrats think further cuts, which would kick in under certain conditions, should be stopped. Others think the cut should be reversed altogether. And Republicans are linking the tax cuts that have gone into effect to the strength of the economy. So I wanted to ask you about where you see things standing now with respect to the debate over business taxes.
Sure. It's a little bit hard to kind of glean which argument on the Democrat side is going to rise to the surface. It seems that the Senate has rallied behind Senator Lou D'Alessandro's proposal to freeze the rate where it is now, which is is at 7.7%. It's on a progression. It's since 2016, it's been on a progression from 8.5% down to eventually 7.5%. It'll get down to 7.5% in 2021 if certain revenue is hit. So the Democrats say we want to freeze it there. We don't need this next step down from 7.7 to 7.5. We can keep it as it is now. But the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Representative Susan Almy, and other Democrats see it differently. They would like to reverse those cuts all the way back to the 8.5%, which at this point, given that they've gone down, would amount to a hike of that amount.
Uh-huh. And are Democrats saying they need the money from these tax revenues for a particular thing?
Well, a big argument that kind of comes up, and this is a perennial argument in New Hampshire, is property taxes and the argument that, you know, a lack of funding for state services downshifts the costs onto towns. And so what you're saving in business tax reductions, you are pushing onto towns. The counterargument from Republicans is that the economy in the state has done very well the last 2 years, and there's a bunch of factors that go into that, but that right now the revenue is doing well. And so they're arguing that there's no need to raise the rates, and if you did raise the rates, then you're going to lose businesses and that revenue won't be as strong.
So what's the next step in the legislative process for any changes to business tax cuts?
Well, it's going to come. It's going to be an interesting one to watch. It's really hard to tell. I talked to the majority leader of the House, Representative Doug Lay, and he said that the House Democrats don't have an official position because they're waiting for it to kind of be settled in the committees and kind of percolate up until there's sort of a caucus-wide position. And that's more characteristic of the House anyways. So whether they kind of do a full reversal up to 8.5%, which would be instantly seized on by Republicans as a tax hike and probably be carried on into the election year, or they go the way of the Senate and just freeze it where it is now, which would be a bit less controversial, it remains to be seen. We don't really know what the narrative is going to come out, but we do know where the Senate stands on it. And we also do know that Governor Sununu is very clear that he wants not only the tax cuts that have gone in to stay, but the future ones as well, because he says that businesses are relying on them.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking about the week's news. And still to come, after the break, I'll be speaking with New Hampshire's first kid governor. A civics education project for young people has declared a winner. And also in this hour, tuna on nachos. What? Yep, we're going to talk about that. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We'll learn more about the week's news in just a little bit. This is The Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Sunset Heights Elementary School in Nashua has a newly elected state official walking its halls. Fifth grader Lola Gianelli was sworn in at the State House last week as New Hampshire's first ever kid governor. What's the kid governor, you ask? Well, 450 fifth graders from five elementary schools across the state participated in what is essentially a hands-on civics education program. They made campaign videos sharing their platform, watched the videos made by their peers, and cast votes for their favorite candidate. And Lola Gianelli was their favorite. She ran on a platform for animal rights, and she's with me now. Lola, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
And how old are you, Lola?
I am 10.
10 years old. Wow. Well, you've accomplished more at 10 years old than I think most of us have at 10 years old. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So you've been kid governor since last week. What have you done so far as your first official acts as kid governor?
Well, my class and I made dog toys in our classroom.
You made dog toys because your platform was animal rights, yes?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Where are these dog toys going to go?
To the Humane Society.
Oh, fantastic. Tell us a little bit about what the election process was like for you. I should ask, is this the first time you've campaigned for any kind of office?
Yes.
All right, so you're one for one as far as victories. how was it? How was campaigning?
It was good. It was good, yeah.
What was it like? What did you have to do to campaign?
Well, I had, one at the school, one at the college, I think it was, and then at the inauguration, but that wasn't really yay.
Right, because the inauguration you had already won. So what was your argument? Why did you say people should care a lot about animal rights?
Because I thought animal cruelty was wrong and that I could make a difference by giving animals a voice.
Mm-hmm. And how did you settle on this as the thing you were most concerned about?
Well, I've kind of, I've not really witnessed it, but I have five animals at home, and I feel like they shouldn't be abused, and I've heard of animals being abused, and it made me really sad, so I felt like I wanted to make a big difference in that.
Oh, excellent. And you ran against a few other kids who wanted to be kid governor, and those young folks are going to be your so-called kid executive council. How will you be working with them? What are you going to do with them?
Well, whatever I do in Nashua, I'll invite them to do in their areas too.
So will they be making dog toys at their schools as well?
I encourage them to do that, yes.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think is the value of this program for you? What have you learned about civic life and being in politics?
Well, I've learned that, one, that you have to, at the inauguration, I learned that you have to, most people, like the Governor Sununu, he had a little pin on, I forgot what it's called, but it's on your suit.
A lapel pin?
they actually gave me the governor's pin that he was wearing.
Oh, was it an American flag or a New Hampshire flag?
Well, it said something, I think it was 1776 it was, and I think it had a bird in the middle, like the eagle.
What else did you learn about the nature of politics?
I forget where we were when I had the inauguration, but it's where people decide if they're gonna, if a bill is going to be a law, I'm pretty sure. And they have little buttons on the side that you would press to answer the questions.
And for those who weren't running for kid governor but did want to vote and did cast votes for you or for the other two young people running with you, what do you think the voters gained from the process?
Well, I think they gained a bit of knowledge on what happened to the animals, because I remember I talked about a few people from the Humane Society who saved a few like 84 Huskies.
And what do you think they learned about the process of voting?
Well, I think they learned how the process of voting works, and that when you do vote, you have to think a bit carefully on why you're voting and how you feel strongly about what you're voting for. So, because if you voted for something that you didn't feel strongly about, why would you be voting for it? And that voting is pretty important.
Does this make you excited to reach the age at which you can vote in state and national elections?
Yes, very excited.
Well, Lola, thank you very much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's the first kid governor, Lola Gianelli. And Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, you were at the event where she was inaugurated.
Yeah, it was really wonderful. I mean, this is the first year of New Hampshire's participation in a program that I think only began 4 or 5 years ago. And it would be great to see more schools get involved. Lola was remarkably poised. Her cabinet was at her side, her executive counselors, I mean. And the event, I could see how it could really inspire an interest in civics education in the kids, even those who weren't involved. The Representatives Hall on the day of her inauguration last Friday was filled with parents and school children from her school and the schools of the two other children who placed as executive counselors. Much of the Nashua delegation was there because Lola is from Sunset Heights in Elementary in Nashua. Each branch of government was represented. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court did the inauguration. The governor spoke. The Majority Leader of the Senate spoke briefly, fortunately. And so it was really a nice event, and I'm sure it inspired a lot of young kids. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see Lola's interest continue and see her as a young state rep candidate 10, 12 years from now, as we've seen others.
Who knows? But at least it does portend good things for the future. that young folks are interested in this way. I want to speak also about the traditional governor that we usually speak about with respect to something we learned this week about Executive Counselor Andrew Valinsky and his ambitions. We learned that he is mulling a run, but he didn't publicly announce it, Dave. It came out because of I guess, a leaked email.
Yeah, Kevin Landrigan reported in Granite Status that Valinsky was generally uncomfortable with the fact that this came out. I don't think he intended for any announcement to be made. From what we can tell, this was a very small number of people he reached out to with a personal email, 5, 6 people maybe. So he was surprised it got out there. He's in no way near ready to make any announcement, even to confirm that he's considering it, although it does seem very likely that he will be a candidate. It also seems likely that Senate Majority Leader Dan Feltes will be a candidate. We don't know whether Colin Van Ostrand will reemerge for another try. And a third-place finisher, former state rep Mindy Mesmer, who finished third place in the congressional race in the first district, might be in it. It's very early. A lot of names are going to bubble up, and we're just going to have to wait and see.
Very early, but is this a symptom of a changing political climate? In other words, is it necessary to start thinking about running for governor this early in a new term for an incumbent governor?
Well, when you have to raise $1.5 million to run for governor in New Hampshire, I think you want to get started early. It also helps stake out a position as a front runner, as an early announcer, I mean, to get ahead of the pack. And it doesn't surprise anyone that there's a lot of Democratic interest because Democratic candidates for governor tend to do better in a presidential year, and 2020 is a presidential year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Valinsky has kind of, you know, throughout his so far brief tenure as an executive counselor, kind of positioned himself in a way that might set him up for, you know, the kind of local interaction that he might need. He's got a very expansive district, District 2, kind of goes from border to border across the state, and he does a lot of constituent stops there. He also is sort of, you know, whether he is running or not, he's positioned himself as a foil to state government for decades now. And so if he wants to kind of cast himself as a fighter against sort of the governor, the present governor Sununu, or, and against sort of the legislature. He's kind of participated in, the Claremont lawsuits. He's also been very, very vocal about the Liquor Commission.
Yeah, he was at the center of that. Actually, Todd Bookman of NHPR did some great reporting on that story, which still seems to evolve. You can find all that reporting at nhpr.org. There's certainly not enough time to recap that story, but it's worth checking out, nhpr.org. I want to ask you about a few more things before the end of the program. Ethan, one is about this testimony lawmakers heard Tuesday on a proposed constitutional amendment that would create an independent commission to draw boundaries for state elections. Ethan, could you tell us a little more about that independent commission?
Sure. So this is something that Democrats have been kind of pushing for years. We'll see what happens this year. But essentially, just to explain how it works now, there's a census every 10 years. And under the current constitution, the state constitution, the House and Senate, the legislature, decides how those districts are drawn. So 24 districts in the Senate, 400 in the House. And there's very little guidance in the Constitution on what those districts are supposed to look like, except that they must be as close to evenly populated as possible. But that leaves, a lot of options for kind of lumping together different towns. When the legislature comes up with this, there's a veto option for the governor. So it kind of works its way like it's a bill. But obviously, it kind of depends who's in charge. So Democrats have been saying for years that the last redistricting, which was done under Republican Speaker Bill O'Brien in the Senate, was tilted against them. And they've been pushing for an independent commission, which would not be legislators, which would draw up these districts themselves. The reason you need a constitutional amendment, so there's a bill.
Yeah, that seems like a big step.
There's a bill by Representative Marjorie Smith. The Constitution is clear that it has to come from the legislature. So the bill, which is just a bill, it doesn't need to go to the voters. The bill would basically also create a commission, but that would be a recommendation to the legislature to then take up. And the legislature could ignore that if they really wanted to. The constitutional amendment would be needed to actually create a permanent commission that would do this every 10 years without the legislature.
With the effect being the depoliticization of the drawing of these.
That's the
in
hope.
Theory.
That's the hope. But, Sununu has already come out against this. I don't think he's been explicitly against it, but he's expressed a lot of doubt about it. And he pointed to the latest election in 2018 as an example that, if the Senate is so poorly drawn, how could Democrats flip the Senate, 14-10 back in their favor? Democrats would say we would have flipped more seats, if it were more fair. But
The most extreme example of gerrymandering in New Hampshire is the Executive Council district that Mr. Valinsky occupies, District Number 2. And I encourage anyone to Google New Hampshire Executive Council districts and take a look at it. It's shaped like a salamander, and that, of course, is the origin of the word gerrymander. And it basically runs horizontally across the state and embraces every one of the major Democratic communities in the southern part of the state, from Portsmouth, Dover, Concord, over to Keene, so as to cluster all the Democratic votes in one district, theory being, well, we'll give them that district, but otherwise they'll be relatively weak, except in a wave year.
And just to add to the politics here, Democrats feel a little bit more confident this year. They've had proposals in the past that have not succeeded on this, but they're kind of looking at the politics of 2020 with an unpopular president and the potential for more gains and potential for more gains in the legislature. They're saying, if we take more seats in the legislature, do you really want us to be drawing the districts like what happened in 2011? And so they think that maybe when push comes to shove, Republican legislators might go along with this idea of taking it out of the legislature, having an independent commission do it, so that no party gains advantage.
Other stories that NHPR and news outlets throughout New Hampshire have been following this week. An effort aimed at supporting Manchester's most vulnerable kids got a boost yesterday. Project Launch, led by the Manchester Community Health Center, is expanding its parenting education classes with a grant from the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. The project's coordinator, Lara Quiroga, says the expanding program focuses on parents of kids under the age of 3 because that's when most of their brain development occurs. Also, Dartmouth Hitchcock and Catholic Medical Center are seeking to combine forces under a new healthcare system. Under the proposal, two hospitals would combine under a new entity called Dartmouth Hitchcock Health Granite One. Catholic Medical Center CEO Joseph Pepe says the deal will better position both hospitals to increase services for rural patients. The combination will require approval from both state and federal regulators, and the process is expected to last into next year. This last thing to talk about did not happen in a news story, but rather on Twitter. Ethan, Dave, I want to quote NHPR's Josh Rogers in a tweet. Apparently, at the end of a press scrum this week, Governor Chris Sununu, I guess in the context of Super Bowl parties, people are going to be watching the Patriots next weekend in the Super Bowl. How does Governor Chris Sununu like his nachos? And this is how he responded, according to Josh Rogers' tweet. Quote, I'll add usually pulled pork on the side. And you know what my new thing is? Tuna. I'll put tuna on my nachos. End quote. That's Governor Sununu. So many questions about the tuna.
I just need to add, the question wasn't actually how do you like your nachos? The question was just what are you doing for the Super Bowl? The governor had absolutely no obligation to bring this up. I mean, he went kind of way out of his way to mention this.
Important part of any Super Bowl party,
sure.
Ethan. You know this.
Sure. He was setting the scene.
I told him, and it's on a tape, Governor, that's a nacho violation. I think a lot of the feedback he got has confirmed that.
Flag on the play.
Sure. I mean, I've looked at there, you know, there are some recipes for tuna nachos. There's also one restaurant in Kingston that actually serves tuna on nachos, but it's ahi tuna steak on nachos, which I think may be a little bit different than the stuff from the can.
So, okay, so you're not just opening a can and plop.
I would
nachos.
Assume not, but I'm not aware of this particular restaurant.
Seeking clarity from the governor, if you'd like to tweet at us about how exactly he likes his tuna on his nachos. And listeners, if you've got a tuna nacho recipe, why not send it to us? exchange@nhpr.org is the email address. Okay, we got to wrap up. Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, thank you very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. Bye.
Thanks also to NHPR Sarah Gibson for joining us earlier in the program. And remember, this conversation continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, and Ali Oshinsky. Special help this week from Rachel Cohen. Jessica Hunt is working the cameras today, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.